Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to be talking about the Code Team, an umbrella for over 100 really cool projects. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 461, recorded November 29th, 2017. The Code Team. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day, totally unaware of it, projects you might want to play with right after this show. Joining me once again is the lovely and talented co-host, Dan Lynch. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here, as always.
Yeah, and you know, it's really great that you've actually sort of got back in sort of a regular rotation. I really appreciate that. And that's just, you were definitely missed while you were gone. It was definitely good to have you back. So thank you very much for that. And where are we? No, you speaking to us from? Probably the usual Liverpool subterranean.
I am. Yes, it's not subterranean. It's the second floor, actually. So it's very much, I don't know what the opposite of subterranean is. It must be like
superterranean,
you know. Superterranean, of course. I should know that on a programming show, shouldn't I? On a tech show. I'm in my usual lair, if you like, near Liverpool, in the northwest of England.
Yes, and I Skype updated itself on me a couple of days ago, and so I'm trying to figure out how to lay out my screen correctly and to get all the screens that I need and all that stuff, and even stupid things now like how to select video and audio. You know, Microsoft can't. Can't be left alone with the source code to Skype, apparently, without messing with it a little bit. So anyway, it's been improved, and we'll see how that actually works today for everything going on. For those who are watching the video, you might see this is my very, very bare wall bedroom in Beaverton, Oregon. And I just flew here from south of the border last night, and so I'm a little tired this morning. Don't think I got quite enough sleep. But hey, I've done it here like that before. It's a travel day, and I just have to deal with that and do the show the next day. So there we go. So today we have coming on in a few minutes, Josh or Joshua Bernstein. He's the Vice President of Technology for Dell Technologies. This is one of the projects that was at, I believe it was All Things Open at org, where I saw these guys, and they were talking about this new push they were doing called Open Curly Brace Code, Close Curly Brace. And I said, well, how do you Google for that? That's, you don't put special characters in your base name. It doesn't work. It's not very good. Anyway, but luckily they gave me the URL to be able to go to the site. What I see there is that this is actually an umbrella project, and there are multiple projects underneath it, some of which I am familiar with, but some of which I've never heard of. So I don't think we're going to talk about all 100 plus projects today. That would be crazy. We're going to be talking about the infrastructure that's there, what Dell has brought to the table, and what the success stories have already been with this thing. So just to name the most popular projects off of the list, Unique, which is the Unikernel compilation deployment platform, Rexray, RackHD, Live Storage, Provega, Mesos Module DVDI, Coper HD, Lab Builder, Code Labs, with curly braces again around code, Poly, Code Vagrant Images, again, curlies around the code there. So it's a nice visual device, but again, how would you Google for that? I do not understand. Mongoose, DVD CLI, that's enough. EMC Zabbix. I do know what Zabbix is. We've had them on the show before, and this must be the EMC version of that. And I think EMC bought Dell a while back, or maybe they're co-owned or something. I can't remember what the relationship was, or maybe Dell bought EMC. I don't know. Anyway, enough of that. Can you contribute anything else to my confusion?
Not a massive amount, but I am familiar with Sputnik, which is the developer Ubuntu preloaded developer laptop that that Dell do. And I had a look through some of the others, and I'm sure we're here to learn. I'm sure Josh will be able to tell us much about what's going on there. And all the different things.
and also deliver the actual message that he wanted to deliver today instead of us just sort of making up what going on there. Before we bring him on, though, we'll bring him on in just a second. I do have a very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's also powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/floss. That's rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I am in Los Gatos, California today. It's a beautiful morning here. I don't know what your weather looks like, but it's lovely here.
I'm Oregon, so it's always raining. If it was raining as I flew in, it's going to be raining all day today. Oh, wait, I see blue sky. I have a chance. Might be a chance. Actually, cool. All right, so now here's somebody with more information than we could possibly get from the website. So let's start. What's the 30,000-foot view? What is the Dell code, I guess, maybe strategy? How did it get started? 30,000-foot view.
So the code team is the open source organization inside of Dell Technologies, and it's designed to sort of encompass all things open source within Dell Technologies. And it does this through a number of ways. One is through contributing to open source projects that are important to us and to our customers. We provide a mechanism to shepherd projects that are inside of Dell out to the community. So you see, you see open source projects that are specific to EMC products or Dell products here and there. Mm-hmm. But really, I think what happens in large corporations is they all have understood or accepted that open source is important to their business and to their customers. And so you have these siloed groups of business units, development teams, even individual developers working to do open source. And there's not really a consistent message. There's not a consistent view. And you get a lot of sort of one-offs. And so code was created to address that. And so we attempt to do this through Dell Technologies by contributing to projects. We have an excellent program called Dev High Five, which allows anybody inside of Dell Technologies, over 100,000 employees, from an individual all the way up through a full-size business unit, to take a project to the open source community. And we help with branding and best practices and infrastructure, messaging, and these sorts of things. And so that's really, I think, the two ideas that Code was founded on. It was actually founded almost 3 years ago now, before the merger of Dell and EMC at Dell. It was originally called EMC Code, and then we became Code by Dell EMC. And at the beginning of this year, we were just sort of elevated to the Dell Technologies level, and we became just simply the Code team. And so to your comments before about how do you Google for that, we don't know necessarily that people are going to be Googling for the Code team, but we do think that people Google for our projects, RexRay and RackHD and so on and so forth. And you can actually Google for the Code team. And a lot of people just call us the Code team for short. And so when we went through our last rebranding, we just became simply the Code team. And you can check us out at thecodeteam.com.
So thank you for coming on. Okay.
I'm happy to be here.
One of the shortest shows I've ever done. No. Okay, so let me back up a little bit next. So you said this became a public face 3 years ago. Had it already been an internal organization within the company?
It hadn't been an internal organization. It was kind of created to be external and be public facing. And at that time, I don't know that anybody really knew what the goal was other than to be part of infrastructure as code and DevOps and to do these sorts of things, fill these product gaps between products and customers. And so it was kind of just created to participate in the community. And when I came on in May of 2015, I tried to put some structure around it and say, okay, we need to have some good tenets. What are good tenets of open source? How do you teach a large corporation how to do open source well? And try to put some structure and some clarity around it. And I think we've done a really good job of that over the last 2 years.
Now, how many of these projects were created originally just an internal tool to Dell or EMC? And how many of these were created from the get-go as it was going to be something that was part of the code team and part of open source and community-based?
It's a really good question. I mean, there's over 100 projects on there. I don't know that I can speak for all of them. Some of them were products, that came from an acquisition or came from a business unit that was developing a product that then they decided they wanted to open source. But the vast majority of them came from individual engineers inside the company that, was working on a particular product that said, a customer said, hey, we want to manage this with Zabbix or monitor this with Zabbix. And mm-hmm. One engineer took the initiative and said, hey, I have this code, I have people using it, but how do I make it public? How do I make it sort of official? And so they go through this Dev High Five program and they, they can sort of take their product to market, if you will, or take their product to the community.
Awesome. Okay. So the, and actually I've just been whispered in my ears that, we normally think of Dell as mostly being a hardware company, and how did software become this important to Dell's business goals?
Well, software is sort of the differentiating factor. I mean, I think if you look at Dell's strategy across the board now, and especially with the acquisition of EMC, their investment, therefore, in VMware, and their ownership of Pivotal, a software company and a company focused on changing software development practices inside large corporations, Dell believes very strongly in software. And thinks that's after all what runs on our servers and runs on our hardware. But now with the two companies being combined in this umbrella organization around Dell Technologies, we really want to provide technical solutions, end to end, that starts with the hardware and that ends with the software and the applications. And so I think it's critical to our strategy. And I think the actions over the past 2 years or so stand for that.
So, Josh, what's the split like between hardware and software kind of employees, if you like, within the company? Because is there lots of developers now coming into Dell? Is that something that's been kind of built up? Did that come through EMC? How does that kind of work?
Well, I mean, if you look at the products that we sell across the board, you mentioned the Sputnik project. Sputnik is a laptop, sure, but there's a tremendous amount of software that Dell develops to empower that product, drivers and software and kernel testing and tuning and all sorts of things. On the server side, there's a tremendous amount of embedded software in those products. There's DRAC and management and the Redfish server management applications. And then if you look at the EMC part of the business, they are storage arrays. You traditionally would think of those of hardware, but really that's software. That's all software that drives those products. It's software that provides the fiber channel communications or the NFS endpoints. It's software that runs all the data services, deduplication and compression and encryption and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Sure, it's running in a specialized hardware package, but it is software at the end of the day.
Mm. And does it help with relations with partners and stuff? Because I'm thinking of being a kind of a Linux guy myself, I'm thinking, obviously, you mentioned Sputnik again, as I did before. I'm thinking of like Ubuntu, Canonical, the makers of Ubuntu. Does it make it easier that you've got like more software engineers on your side and you can kind of get your heads together and say, let's get this working the way we want it to work on our hardware?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not so much about, the business strategy. I think the business strategy is not so much about taking Ubuntu off the shelf or taking Red Hat off the shelf and just making it work on our hardware. Sure, that's part of it, but it's also about contributing back to the broader community. Dell participates in kernel development and driver development and all sorts of things, obviously to make Ubuntu work, but also to, make Linux an overall better experience for our customers and for the entire Linux community. So I think, at this point, I think we take the business strategy part of it for granted a little bit, because the focus is really on, we want to provide a Linux-based laptop that has a phenomenal experience soup to nuts. And if it comes down to having to work in, the automated power modules in the Linux kernel to make that happen, that goes upstream, that goes back to the community. And as well as, you know, sort of writing the drivers for our hardware is kind of, you know, that's table stakes. But it's really about, you know, making the experience better for our customers and better for the community.
I mean, I am actually, I'm just thinking of it must be almost 10 years ago now. I don't really want to think that it's that long, but it is. Dell started selling commercial user laptops with Ubuntu Linux, and I bought an M1330, which was a lovely model, kind of a MacBook equivalent, I would have said at the time, MacBook Pro. And one of the things I really appreciated was they actually provided an Ubuntu-based tool for flashing the firmware on the motherboard, and that was really, really nice, because lots of manufacturers could care less about, you know, whether you can flash it from Linux or whatever. So I mean, it works both ways, and that, obviously, as you said, a lot of developers are going to want to run other operating systems and stuff. So it's good to be popular with developers, I imagine, if that makes sense. That's not too obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the strategy that we've recognized and the importance. I mean, you know, people say these days, sort of to pick up an old cliche, is software is eating the world, and developers are the authors of software. And so to be relevant in this industry, I think, you know, part of the reason why Code was created was to be relevant in sort of this new and emerging world with developers, with people that want to write software, write infrastructure as code, practice agile development, you know, do all this. This is all software. And if you don't have software people, or if you're not developing products for these individuals, then I don't know how you can be relevant otherwise. And that's really, I think, the broader strategy that we've tried to take. And that's certainly been a focus of Code.
And it makes sense. It makes total sense. I mean, it would be silly for a bicycle manufacturer to make bicycles that cyclists don't want to ride. Professional cyclists, you know, or serious cyclists, if you like. So it makes sense. So I'm interested in, obviously, as Randall said, there's like 100 plus, projects under the umbrella that you've got here. So we're not going to talk about all of them unless you want to do 10 seconds on each one. But I don't think that's really fair. We'll have a counter. So how many of the projects originated from EMC and came over, and how many were in Dell? And have you seen a big uptake of people adding projects from, you know, your own staff and so on?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is... you know, there's over 100 projects that we have listed. Relatively few of them have come from the Code team directly. The vast majority of them are from other engineers and other business units that are a part of Dell and a part of EMC. You know, my team specifically has been focused in the container space and dealing with a pet peeve of mine, which is around running persistent applications inside of containers. And so the vast majority of those projects come from my team specifically. I guess it's not really a majority. They all do. but it's projects like RexRay and LibStorage and these sorts of things that you see on the website were all sort of founded by, hey, look, I switched, you know, I ran a very, very large containerized environment with Siri at Apple. And one of the pet peeves that I had was, as we moved over to storage, or as we moved over to containers, there was this problem with how do you run, you know, a MySQL database or a Postgres database inside a container. And this was a pet peeve of mine. And when I was at Apple still, I remember telling my director very clearly, I was like, I'm going to solve this problem. And it just turned out that I had to leave Apple to go do it, and ended up, you know, developing and releasing RexRay, which does storage orchestration for containers. It connects a container runtime like a Kubernetes or a Mesos to, down to a storage provider, whether it be an EBS volume on Amazon, a storage product from Dell EMC, or, you know, Google or Azure, whatever the case may be. It actually provides storage orchestration, I think, for the first time, allows one to run persistent applications inside containers very effectively. On the other projects, you know, we have RackHD, which came in through an acquisition that EMC made prior to the merger. Another project we have is called Provega. Provega came out of it's supported by a full business unit inside of Dell EMC. Around big data and streaming data. So I'm very excited about that one. That's relatively new. And then there's, you know, the host of other projects come from a wide variety of people across the organization, but it's really just empowering them to reach out to the community, show that they're supportable, and be relevant to our customers at the end of the day.
Okay. Well, let's. I was actually going to ask you what Rexray was, and you already answered it. So well done there. That's okay. No, that's good. So let's talk a bit about the history of Rexray then, and what's coming up maybe in the future. I know you've just had a fairly recent release, which is, let's get the number right, 0.11, I believe, 0.11. So can you tell us a bit about that and what's changing and what excites you about Rexray?
Yeah, you know, this is just an area of the open source and of the technology space that I was just so frustrated with. With Rexray 0.11, Rexray, despite the version number, I know some people get hung up on the version number, that project's been around for roughly 2 years now. And with Rexray 0.11, you know, the goal, I think, of the journey has been to push all of the functionality of Rexray, which does the storage orchestration between the storage providers and the container orchestrators, sort of upstream into the container orchestrators and then downstream into the storage providers. And in the meantime, that wasn't going to happen, so Rexray was developed. With 0.11, we've been pushing a standard through the community called the Container Storage Interface, or CSI. And this is essentially a common API or a common specification that storage providers can write to and container orchestrators can write to. And the 0.11 release for Rexray marks the first time that the CSI was implemented and makes Rexray immediately relevant to both sides of that puzzle. And I'm thrilled. You know, it's a 2-year journey, and it's great. Now we see at KubeCon next week, in fact, we're going to see Kubernetes release alpha support for CSI. Mesosphere will release CSI support in their release later in December. And so we're finally seeing sort of industry adoption of this specification, and Rexray has kind of shepherded that in.
I was just having a look at the project on GitHub as well, and there's 165 forks of it at the moment, which is cool. So it kind of almost answers the question I was going to ask you, which is, have you seen a lot of people contributing from outside Dell to this as well? I mean, how's it been accepted in the community, if you like?
It's been great. I mean, I think what's been fun for me as part of the journey is explaining to Dell people that success of this actually looks like our competitors contributing and forking and being involved. And that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing engineers at other companies that would traditionally compete with Dell EMC participate in Rexray. We're seeing other partners of Dell EMC contribute. It's really amazing to see, and it's an amazing conversation to have with a lot of the team and my peers inside of Dell. Is like, look, this is a good thing that our competitors involved and our competitors contributing, ultimately, you know, the goal here is to solve the problem for the community and solve the problem for customers. And from the business side, when you do something like Rexray and you can go talk to a customer about Rexray, it's about being relevant. A lot of new customers, you know, don't want to hear about what the roadmap for our bare metal server is. They either know or it's not interesting. But if we can have higher valued conversations, we become more relevant. And that's what a lot of this open source work is really about.
Oh, hey. Hi. Sorry. I was reading out the bottom of the screen here for a second. Yeah, I got distracted by chats and stuff back again. All right. Hey, so I was just thinking, you kept saying CSI, and you've got to have a poster made up somewhere photoshopped in of Rexray CSI television show.
That's really funny. We'll work on that. We have a phenomenal artist we work with. If you read a lot of our blogs that talk about Rexray and talk about our projects, you'll see that Rex is sort of the team mascot. And yes, he's been dressed up in everything from Elvis when we did a show in Vegas. My favorite one is Tex Rex. You know, we do a lot of shows in Austin, Texas, so he puts on a cowboy hat and boots. But we haven't done a CSI one yet, but I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. So you can credit me when it comes out, or at least send me a copy. That would be fun.
I'll send you a copy for sure.
And I'll show it on a future show if you send it to me. That'll be great. One of the things that my primary client right now is ZipRecruiter, and they're moving towards containers. But one of the things they're focusing on is this idea of 12-factor apps, which is exactly opposite problem. I mean, it's about not having persistent things inside containers. They should all be external services, things like that. Is this sort of counter to that then? Is this heading in a different direction? And if so, what do you think of the 12-factor app theories?
So the funny thing is, and I'll have a blog coming out just on this topic. You know, what 12-factor said was apps in containers. A lot of people think they said apps and containers should be stateless. That's not really what they said. What they said was that they should consume state through an endpoint or through a URL or a URI or through some sort of API. There's a phenomenal meme that went around the internet that says storage is just, you know, it's not part of stateless. It's just storage is just somebody else's problem. And so what I see this container storage interface really being is an evolution of that. How is it that we can make storage transparent and consumable via an API or through software to applications? And that's really what CSI is a part of. If CSI is implemented properly inside of the container orchestrator, then the application just doesn't have to worry about storage anymore. It consumes the storage through an endpoint, much like 12-factor sort of envisioned or wanted. It was just that when that document was first published by the great engineering team at Heroku, it just wasn't possible technically. The app still was very concerned with what is my mount point and how are the fiber channel LUNs set up and so on and so forth. And with CSI, the app can say, I need a volume of 100 gigs or 100 gigabytes, or I need a volume with all the gigs. And the container orchestrator delivers that endpoint transparently. So I really think that the container storage interface in CSI is an evolution of what 12-factor laid out. It is sort of the manifestation or the epitome, if you will, of what they desired. It's just that when it was first talked about, it just wasn't possible. The technology wasn't there.
So is Rexray sort of in the same space then as Kubernetes and Mesos, or is it some service that these like Kubernetes would use?
Well, as it stands today, it's a service that Kubernetes and Mesos can leverage. If you think about Rexray playing the middleman between Kubernetes and between the storage provider of your choice, that's kind of the way it's architected right now. Kubernetes says, give me a volume of 100 gigabytes. And Rexray says, here you go. Mesosphere and Docker and Cloud Foundry work the same way. And so it's existed for this long period of time, 2 years, I guess, is a long period of time in technology as this middleman. But the ultimate vision is not to require the middleman to have this functionality native in Kubernetes and native in Mesosphere and then native in the storage providers and the storage backends. And that's really where CSI is evolving to. And that's really where Rexray is evolving to. I think if we do this correctly over the next year or so, maybe Rexray goes away because this is a solved problem and the team moves on to something else. I don't know.
It seems like containers have both solved a lot of problems and created a lot more interesting problems. I think it just pushed it back one layer. I mean, we're sort of now at with containers where we were with virtualization and virtual machines maybe 8 years ago, somewhere in there, you think?
Right. Yeah, and that's how I know I'm old. Because I sort of see the same, you know, I think that's people say, well, you're so young. I was like, but I feel old. I feel like the same set of problems that we were discussing with virtualization were now just substituting with containers. A big one was security. You remember years ago, people were like, well, virtual machines are not secure. And suddenly here we are. And like virtualizing is the de facto security standard. And we're seeing the same sort of thing happen with containers. I think the one difference between containers and virtual machines is that a container only packages up the application and its dependencies. It doesn't package up the operating system and the kernel and the rest of sort of that semantic that a virtual machine does. And I think that paradigm shift is really powerful for empowering developers. It really sort of moves the line up a little bit, up a level to empower developers to deliver a deployable artifact that is not dependent on the underlying infrastructure. You can deploy containers on top of virtual machines. I think that's a very legitimate a model. But the idea here is that it doesn't it provides a line of abstraction at what I think the right level is. And I'll give you an example. I'll expand on this a little bit.
Sure. Thanks.
Famously, I don't know about you guys. I have some young kids and they read this book called If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. And the joke that I had, you know, deploying one of the world's largest virtualized environments was, if you give a developer a virtual machine, what do they want? Well, then they're going to want disks, and then they're going to want network, and then they're going to want you to update this version of Python and that version of Java, and then they break this version of Java. They want you to roll back. And so you get these tickets about sort of updating middleware packages. And as an infrastructure operator, as a DevOps person, I don't really want to do that. But because of the virtual machines construct, that's sort of the position we've all put ourselves in. But when you move to a container, you empower the developer to make those middleware decisions on their own and not really involve you. Your job becomes running the container. And if they want to change versions of Java or Python or Ruby or Go or do whatever they want to do, they can do that and encompass it in the container, and they can leave sort of the kernel and the infrastructure underneath it up to me. So it really moves that line of abstraction up, and I think into a much more sustainable place.
And there's let's go the other direction for a second now, because AWS just announced that they're going to have bare metal EC2s. That's sort of in the other direction, because basically then you have to own the whole machine, although you can then put container orchestration on top of that, I imagine.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I saw that announcement this morning too. I think it's great that Amazon gave you bare metal. What that does, you know, for some people, I think, is help them with their migration to the journey to the cloud. If you're a big VMware shop and you want to run VMware in the cloud now you can deploy ESX, or now you can deploy Hyper-V, or you can deploy your own virtual machine. On bare metal, which I think is fabulous. For containers, it's also excellent. And for a lot of applications that really demand a higher level of performance or a guaranteed level of performance, getting a virtual or getting raw or bare metal is incredibly powerful. And I think it was only an evolution of time before Amazon made that happen. So I'm thrilled for that. I think that's going to unlock a tremendous amount of possibilities for our enterprise customers in migrating to the cloud. And it's going to unlock a tremendous amount of applications that have historically required, you know, lots and lots of predictable performance. And that's what Amazon's delivering. I think it's fabulous.
And for people who watched the show a few weeks ago, we had an announcement between Packet and the CNCF being able to deliver bare metal machines for open source projects just by requesting it, just for free, which I thought was really cool too. So I'm excited to see where that's actually going to go. Can I ask you a Siri question?
Sure, you can ask me anything.
Okay, sure.
I may not know the answer, but you can ask me anything. You can ask me anything.
What's the weather like in downtown San Francisco?
That's a Siri question.
Yeah. Yeah, Siri question. Yes. I do have to actually share one quick Siri story. I was on a panel at Dragon Con, and we were in the sort of radio poor section of one of the hotels. Dragon Con's got 60,000 attendees, and I was on a panel there, and somebody's iPhone went off and said, keep in mind this is a science fiction fantasy conference, okay? So somebody's phone went off because it couldn't contact the mothership. I forget what the phrase is, something like, I'm sorry, I don't have network right now, or something like that. I'm afraid I can't do that right now. And I leaned over to my mic and I said, shut up, Siri, which you'll get if you get Star Trek reference. But anyway, shut up, Stella from... They thought that was funny. Okay, you guys... wasn't playing to the right audience here.
Sorry, bad audience.
There's 17 people at home right now, hilariously laughing.
Yeah, they're dying.
Oh, exactly, just not here. So I was wondering, I've just actually been listening to Welcome to Macintosh, or whatever it's called, the little podcast. They were talking about the original voice of Siri, and I was wondering why you hadn't chosen the voice of Asterisk, Allison Smith, for that.
I don't know why the voice or who the voice was chosen. I know that when we redid the voice, it was auditioned like a role in a Hollywood voiceover. I don't know how the original voice was chosen, but I know that as the voice has evolved, it's been auditioned several times, and there's actors and actresses that are the voice of Siri. They obviously can't talk about it until many years after the voice has changed, but. And I'm guessing the first voice was an audition in the same way, but I actually don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, and you also said in the opening that you had to leave away from the Siri project to be able to do these things at I guess first at EMC or wherever you moved to. Have they gone back? Do you know if they've gone back and started to adopt some of the practices that you're now creating?
I think that, you know, I'm speculating here purely, but I know that they run a very large containerized shop. And I think that they still had some of the pain points that we were struggling with our additional deployments. I still see some of those people at conferences and things like that. And they are, I believe they are participating and they are involved in consuming it. Apple's very secretive on these sorts of things, so they don't come out and say it. But I think in my heart of hearts that they are involved and they are consuming and gone back to some of the things that are now available.
So we talked about RexRay. We talked a little bit about RackHD. And I don't remember, we talked about Live Storage. What are some of the other more interesting projects that you're aware of that are currently under the Code umbrella?
Let's see. I'll name some of the few of them that I have. The new one that we have is Pravega. Pravega is designed to be an open source big data, you know, streaming storage processing platform that is being developed into a product inside of Dell. But we thought that it was important to take the Pravega piece of it and open source it. And if you go to the website and check out Pravega, you'll see it has some properties of Kafka, but mainly focused for streaming data. It's very, very optimized for streams, writing to large-scale backend storage. And you can see applications for products like this in healthcare, especially in the Internet of Things and the IoT space. I think these types of platforms will be very, very important. And so I'm excited to see where Pravega goes. It's fun, right? Because while Code sort of brings the project to the community and makes sure that they follow a certain set of principles around transparency and consumption, we don't necessarily own the roadmap, but we do make sure that they are developing the project in a way that is good for the community and good for open source. A few of my other favorite projects, we have one you mentioned at the top of the show on labs, and the labs are Vagrant images essentially that with a simple Vagrant up, you can have a full blown Mesos and Kubernetes cluster at your fingertips to deploy, to play with, to set up, cool. to run, to sort of get your toes wet, I guess is the expression. And it's fun because you see this being used across the board. You see our sales engineers and our pre-sales people using this for demonstration purposes in customer meetings. You see this being used at conferences to do demos of other projects that people have worked on. But it's kind of a great way where people say, hey, I really like this container thing. And I'm debating between Mesos and Kubernetes. What do you think I should do? And my advice to them is always just pick one, but also like play with them and make an informed decision. And the Vagrant images provide a very quick way for people to sort of get up to speed very quickly. So that's another one of my favorite ones. And then you'll see a wide variety of projects that are maintained to bridge the gap between our products and like infrastructure as code projects like Puppet and Chef and Ansible. Our more sophisticated customers say, I really love your storage product, but I'd like to deploy it with Puppet. And historically, sales teams and product teams don't really understand that. Does something like a Puppet module for Scale.io belong inside of that BU? Or does the customer developer, where does it happen? Code has kind of stepped up here and the community has stepped up here and provided that infrastructure as code to fit our products and make them relevant in existing customer environments. And that's really powerful.
Okay. It's all great projects. Sounds like really fascinating stuff and obviously filling a well-needed gap, to use that malapropism. But one of the things that, and you sort of alluded to it a moment ago, you were talking about roadmap. Now I'm wondering then, for the internal projects that became external, how is the governance working for that? Are these all creating separate committees to oversee the roadmap? Is it that still pretty tightly held by Dell? What do you see?
Well, one of the things that happens when a project comes through the Dev High Five program is it goes through a sort of series of litmus tests, and we don't just put our name and put our support behind everything that comes through. One of the key tests in this program is, are you developing and working on the project transparently? I think transparency is real key, and it's a hard yes. It's a hard idea for a traditional business unit to understand. But the roadmap for all the projects that are in code is public and is transparent. There might be ideas and things that are being kicked around, but the roadmap is out there, is available. And if it's not, then it doesn't really pass this litmus test. And we ask these project maintainers or product maintainers to go back and say, look, if you really want to do this open source and be successful, this is a requirement. And that's something that they've learned and taken to heart. So even, you know, my team's, roadmap, the roadmap for the code team ourselves, what conferences we're going to, what papers we're submitting, what projects we're working on, that's all public. You can go to a repo on our GitHub called Roadmap, and you can see who's going to write a blog about what topic coming up and what projects we're going to work on and what conferences we're going to be at. And we are as transparent as possible as a way to sort of, you know, be an example of how good open source projects work. For one of the pieces of infrastructure that we provide projects in the Dev High Five program is a Skype a Slack channel, and we've worked really hard at this over the last 2 years. We have a community on Slack called Code Community, and it's a community I think of over 4,500 individuals at this point that are talking about open source projects, our mm-hmm. projects or other projects, and really providing a place for people to come talk. Our customers come talk about our products. Our community comes talk about our projects. And there's also channels on there for you know, sort of anything that might be interesting. I am a big drone racing nut. And so we have conversations in there on a daily basis about drone racing, for example, or Raspberry Pi or blockchain or anything that's interesting. We've really spent a tremendous amount of time developing this community, and the community manager, Jonas Roslin, for the code team has done a phenomenal job with this.
It sounds excellent. I mean, one thing I was interested in is, I mean, so far, obviously, you're taking internal projects mostly, or people who are already in the organization come to you and they want to open source stuff, as you discussed. Do you think I don't know if you can answer this, but in the long run, do you think Dell might be interested in shepherding external projects in any way? Because you find some small projects, they need resources. Like they say, oh, we haven't got enough money, or we haven't got, we need, you know, a bank account. We need other things. I know there are some organizations out there that do that, but, you know, we'll provide an umbrella, like software in the public interest or Software Freedom Conservancy and things like that. But if someone came to you, like an open source developer who's developing a little thing that might be of interest to Dell and might have something to you, and said, would you be able to help me get this off the, you know, off the ground? Is that something that would work for you guys? Is that something you'd be interested in, or is that maybe a step too far?
No, you know, it's actually a very timely question. We were approached by a project outside of Dell's organization that basically said, hey, you know, we've seen you around, you guys are doing great work. Can we take our project through code and get it supported by code? And you know, at one point we were like, wait, we hadn't even thought that that was a possibility. And so, you know, on one hand, I was extremely flattered by being approached in that way. And we're actually discussing, you know, how we will handle these sorts of requests moving forward. I think it's a possibility. I think it's certainly something we can be open-minded to. We just have to make sure it makes sense. You know, there are a lot of other organizations already established that provide this type of value and this type of benefit. You know, the Apache Foundation, CNCF, the Linux Foundation, and there are already sort of these nonprofit organizations that may or may not be a better home or a better organization to provide that level of support for these projects. But what we're happy to do is sort of help with those introductions, help with that guidance, help with recommendations. And so that's you know, that's I think a much more likely path, but doesn't mean we'd be against anything unlike you suggested moving forward. It has to make sense, and we're thinking about it right now.
Yeah, it was actually in relation to something like the Apache Foundation that I was thinking, you know, of a model a bit like that. You're right, it's a different, I mean, the Apache Foundation is a different entity and has different maybe goals to what Dell does overall. But as you've been saying all the way through, this really could help with Dell's overall, you know, business goals in you know, to help and give stuff back, which is what you've been doing, which is great. I was curious about licenses as well, because I'm a bit of a licensing geek, which is just not that interesting, I know, to most people. I noticed most of the projects under Apache 2, the ones that you've released, do you prescribe Apache 2? If someone comes to you internally and says, I've got this thing, I want to release it under like GPL v3 or something, is that something you would consider, or do you have a license preference, I suppose I'm asking?
We do have certain sets of license preferences. Most of our preference has historically been a list of licenses that we won't support. But I, you know, I'm not a license nerd, but I do think the Apache license is generally a very good one. And that's sort of the one that we will recommend and talk about. And the projects, you know, we don't provide governance over the projects or the individuals submitting the projects. We don't say you have to use, you know, this license in this case. We do tell them, you know, here are the pros and cons. Here's the things that you should look out for. We happen to like, you know, the Apache license, or in this case, maybe you should use a different license or some variant of the Apache license for whatever individual reason they have. You know, we're not providing the governance. You know, this is sort of the way that that CNCF, the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, and the Linux Foundation kind of manage their projects. They're providing an organization, they're providing a bank account, they're providing structure, but they're not providing these demands. The projects are sort of free to govern and support themselves. The LF and the other organizations are there to provide structure, and that's kind of the model that we've adopted with the code team inside of Dell. To your question earlier, we, you know, Dell is a very large sponsor of the Linux Foundation, and we are a platinum member of the CNCF, and so we contribute. You know, Dell contributes financially to those organizations in an effort to sort of support the community, and so far that's been the best model. But again, it's not really about us demanding a governance model. It's about us providing recommendations and guidance. And you know, of the 100 or so projects that we've shepherded, the Apache model seems to be the good fit.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Hey, we're almost out of time, and I'm going to ask you the most difficult question I always ask everybody, because it's a set subtraction problem. Is there anything you wanted to talk about that we didn't get to today that you want to make sure our audience is still left with?
No, I think we did a very good job covering it. I'll tell your audience that if you are interested in what the code team is doing, and you're interested in the projects we've discussed around the container storage interface and Rexray and some of the others, the whole team will be at KubeCon next week in Austin, Texas. If you guys are there, please come see me, come see the team. We're always happy to meet people and have further conversations. If I said something that offended you, please come tell me. Or if you want to talk about something further, please come tell me. You can reach out to me on Twitter at @quityourjoshing, or email me from thecodeteam.com. But we want to meet people. We want to be involved in the community. And so I just wanted to encourage that.
Awesome. I have to ask two required questions, or else my audience actually gets mad at me and emails me. What's your favorite scripting language?
Scripting language or programming language?
Boy, nobody's ever drawn that distinction before. We've had people say things like, groovy and stuff like that. So I guess it's sort of anything goes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these days I'm writing a lot of code in Go. Go is not necessarily a scripting language, right? It's compiled. I would, you know, a stretch there. I'm writing a tremendous amount of Go. I've written Ruby, and I'm old enough to have written Perl. So, but Go is, you know, you'll see the vast majority of projects from the code team are all in Go, and you know, a lot of Kubernetes is written in Go, and that's just sort of, you know, where I'm at, just interest wise. I'm not a language aficionado. I just kind of write in whatever language everybody else is writing in, and just kind of deal with it, because, you know, fitting in with the community and kind of going, it's just not an argument I get involved with. So Go would be my answer. That's a short answer.
It's a very short answer. It's only two characters. Short answer. Almost a short, well, C would have been a slightly short.
I was going to say C. You could have said that.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Or D.
I need a letter.
Yeah. Any letter, actually. It's probably R. You could have said R. That would have worked too. Anyway,
I've done a lot of R in my day. That's true.
And what text editor you spend all day in?
I still use Vim. I get made fun of relentlessly for it. You know, all of the hip kids are using Atom and all these like native applications, Savitha Edit and all this stuff. And I still open up a terminal and fire up Vim. I'm old school that way. I thought you were going to ask me the tabs and spaces question, but the editor
is a lot easier. No. I'm never going to start that kind of religious war on my show. It's a little too much.
You just asked me the text editor question. That's equally religious, yeah. I think.
It's true, but I'm hoping somebody again says Emacs. That's all, because it's still the one I spend most of my time in. But I've just started using a VS Code for my work in Dart and Flutter. So that's I'm finally going to an actual IDE. Finally, after all these decades of being inside Emacs, which is not quite an IDE, it doesn't have some of the same support. So anyway, enough of that. We're almost out of time. So Josh, I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking to us about code. And the team and what Dell is doing, and really appreciate that. And so thank you for taking your time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate being here. Maybe you'll have me back sometime.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. When you get to 200 projects, let me know.
All right, I'll let you know.
Then we can talk aimlessly on about other things that we don't have any experience with. It's all good. All right, good. Well, we got to go on. That was Josh, and I scrolled his name out of the way. Josh Bernstein. There we go. Yeah, that's it. Exactly. Right. What do you think there, Dan?
Dan, you've got my name as well. I answer to most things. It's not a problem. Great. Really interesting stuff. It's great to see what Dell are doing now. And you know, I mean, we didn't really have to. At the start, we talked about Skype and how our gripes with it. And I was really wanting to say, if Skype was open source, we could have fixed this by now. But you know what I mean? It's great to see big organizations getting into open source development. And it sounds as though they're doing it from the right, the right kind of position, if you like. As he said, they're not looking to put like governance on projects as such. They want to help them blossom and become their own thing, which I really like. I think that's a really good message.
Yeah, it just sounds really good. And again, drawing the comparison towards the end there with the Apache Foundation and what they provide for people and other organizations like that, it's sort of like there's a lot of need for people to come together and share common concerns and criticisms and infrastructure. And so it's great that this is all happening. Okay, so I got to wrap it up real quick here because I've got a hard out coming up really quick. Next week, we've got Suse, a representative from the Suse Project. We've had people from the Suse Project on the show before, but not talking specifically about Suse, which I thought was really amazing. So they're coming on next week. And actually, a lot of stuff has happened to Suse, too. Linkerd, which is a transparent proxy that adds service discovery, routing, failure handling. So one of these cool things. Just at the beginning of the new year, we're going to bring back the bacon. John O'Bacon's going to come back on. He wrote the seminal book called The Art of Community in 2009, but a lot has happened since then. And so he's going to update us on the evolution of the art of community, which is really, really cool. Following that, the Open Mainframe Project, which I belittled a couple weeks ago and got taken to the coals for that. Yes, a lot of us are still using mainframe machines that are running Linux and stuff. So this is all good. And then the only other scheduled item I have right now is Process Maker, which is a workflow manager, which, of course, since I only have 5 shows scheduled, I better start getting my act together and start emailing everybody and trying to get those slots filled, because slots are important. Well, empty slots are bad. Full slots are good. All right. You can go to see where our slots are filled at twit.tv/floss, the homepage for this show. Linked from there is the big spreadsheet, as I like to call it. If you have any other suggestions, please tell the project leader or community coordinator to email me. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time, Wednesdays, at live.twit.tv. We take a number of questions from there every time. Sometimes that number is 0, but we do take a number of questions from there, always. Oh, I made that up a few months ago, and I really like it. Okay, you follow us on Floss Weekly on Google+, which tweets over to @FlossWeekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google+. That's my primary blogging platform right now. And that also tweets over to @Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N. And I occasionally drop just tweets by themselves on there, but mostly I source everything over on Google+. My plugs for today. I have just been informed that today is Leo's birthday. Leo Laporte, our executive producer in chief, it's his birthday today. So happy birthday, Leo. Thank you for letting me do this show, even though I screw it up sometimes. Yes. Also, I'm supposed to read this. What are your favorite segments, shows, or moments on Twit this year? We are putting together our best of episodes and want your help. Head over to twit.tv/bestof. That's one word, B-E-S-T-O-F. Fill out the form with whatever information you remember and be a part of making these special shows that will air the week between Christmas and New Year's. So please do that. Also, one last plug. Last week we had Sarah on talking about JewelBots, and she mentioned that there would be a buy one, get one free sale on Black Friday. I did buy a pair. They're not here yet, but I bought a pair of JewelBots so I can experiment with using it to control my laptop. I'm going to see if I can Bluetooth bind it to my laptop. She says nobody's done that before. So, yay! I can finally program an Arduino in C++ like all the cool kids. Literally the cool kids. All right. Anything for you to plug? Dan?
Just head to danlynch.org, which you can see in the, if you're watching the video, is in the bottom there, and you can find out what I'm up to via the blog.
Okay, well, that was fast. Good, thank you. And so, Dan, I appreciate once again you coming on the show, talking to us, and helping me out behind the scenes as well, and having a lot more knowledge about Linux than I would ever have. So that's always handy. And so, thank you, and I appreciate your work.
No problem. I'm glad there's at least one thing I might know more about than you. Everything else, probably not. But Linux, I'm happy that I might know a little bit more about that. So yeah, thanks again, as always, and I'll see you again soon.
Hey, you're welcome back anytime. All right, and we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.
Floss Weekly.